This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Laura Kaneshi, who is a broker associate for RE/MAX in LaPorte. And she tells us about a new report that is out, the 2018 Market Trends Report on single-family housing trends and data for Indiana, and in particular for Northwest Indiana. We'll find out more about that. We'll also have a conversation with Jill Gonzalez, an analyst for WalletHub.com. WalletHub.com has just put out the new ranking of states with the biggest drug problems, and unfortunately, Indiana is ranked at number 7. And we have another conversation as well for you for today from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Spring buyers for homes here in Northwest Indiana, for that matter across the state of Indiana, are facing even higher prices and fewer choices these days when it's time to look for a home. And there's a reason behind it all. And the latest RE/MAX Integra Midwest 2018 Market Trends Report is out and tells us more information about it. To find out more, let's check in with a broker associate for RE/MAX in LaPorte, Laura Kaneshi. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit here about this report. We've heard, of course, about RE/MAX, but we don't know how Integra Midwest seems to fit into it.
Certainly. Not unlike the whole nation, we are seeing a huge influx, not only in market prices increasing, but also, too, with a limited inventory for existing homes and home sales. So we have seen a very competitive and aggressive market, this year in 2018, which has followed suit from most likely what we saw in 2017 as well. So this report reflects, certainly the same. Home prices are up across the Tri-County, Lake LaPorte, and Porter counties, with LaPorte seeing the largest increase of average home sales, up 33% from this time last year.
Now, how do the folks manage to get the information together to be able to put this report together?
Through the MLSs, so the multiple listing services. All homes that are sold on the MLS are all the data is sent down to corporate and downstate as well. So all that data is compiled from true sales that are documented from quarter to quarter.
Now, I know the information for Indiana shows that there's about an 8% increase in the average price for a home that's sold around the state of Indiana, according to the report. And how does Northwest Indiana, in particular, with the counties that are in the report, including Lake and Porter and LaPorte counties, how do they fit into this?
In part for the course, we're seeing, certain cities, Valparaiso has the highest average. They're up roughly 9%. As I alluded to earlier, LaPorte has seen the largest increase with 33% from this time last year. Maryville is up about 10%, and even Gary is up around 9% from this time last year. So regardless of, geographical borders, we are seeing, a steady increase in the region, Northwest Indiana.
Now, we mentioned here at the start of our conversation about the fact that there are not only higher prices for homes being sold, but there are fewer choices as well. Tell us how the inventory seems to fit into all of this, both good and bad.
Certainly. It all depends. Right now, we're looking at it, it's a seller's market. The market is hot, and that is being driven by supply and demand. The limited inventory is also the major contributor to the increased sales prices as well. You're having a lot of qualified buyers out there, multiple buyers buying for the same property. Home sales, the price points themselves, but then also to the competitive nature is driving up those home sales even further. I attribute that mainly, like I stated, to supply and demand. The steady economy, also to the really low unemployment rates, the financing rates. While they've increased a little over the last 18 months, we're still, pretty darn close to all-time lows, making qualified buyers being able to purchase more homes than they were able to, let's say, 5 years ago. This has had a good impact or a great impact on the luxury and vacation and second home markets. It's really demonstrating consumer confidence. So, you know, folks that are going in for the second homes and vacation homes, they probably always had this liquidity or ability to buy, but now they're gaining that confidence back in the markets, both stock market and housing market, to go out and spend the discretionary cash that they may have.
Now, we know that home builders are starting to pick up in some of their activities. I think they've been spurred on, I'm sure, by the fact that there are so few homes, existing homes, that are out there to be able to draw from. In fact, we just note here just recently that in the town of St. John, they're getting ready to plan for two fairly large housing complexes in that particular area. And there are more, of course, all across Northwest Indiana. How do the new constructions seem to fit in and into what you all get to work with, I guess, and be able to recommend to your clients?
Absolutely. So new construction is very integral in the continuation of the housing market. With limited inventory in the existing market, we need to lean heavily onto consumers, contacting builders and builders even building spec homes in anticipation for, the continuation of what we're seeing in the marketplace right now. Without the new construction, we're going to be hopelessly deadlocked, and where sellers are going to be afraid to sell because they won't have their next step, where they're going to go to next.
Right.
If they're going out of state or, going to other markets, that's one viable option. But oftentimes, people want to, say where their roots are and either buy up or, maybe downsize. So builders, home building is a key component in keeping the real estate market afloat.
I was wondering, in fact, you just kind of mentioned here about the fact that we have homeowners basically it's time for them maybe to move. I guess they're empty nesters, perhaps. They have family members that have left. They're looking for a smaller place to live, but they're having trouble, I'm sure, trying to find one. Even if they want to buy a new house, a smaller house, it's still going to be pretty difficult for a while, isn't it?
It is. So, as we spoke, we need new construction to help keep us afloat. So folks will ask me all the time, do you see the inventory lining up? Do you think this is going to get better? I think that we at least, we're about a good 3 to 5 years, maybe even 7 years out. If we look at the average cycle of somebody, staying in their home, right now, sellers and homeowners are forced to stay in their homes longer because they don't have their next step. The next property that they're going to. So it will lighten up, but we need to continue to see that new construction to have that available inventory in the future.
Now, let me ask you, Laura, as a realtor with REMAX there in LaPorte County, are you finding with the clients that you work with that many folks, besides, of course, getting somebody trying to sell a house, getting a lot of offers for that particular house, are you finding some clients are actually dropping any plans to have inspections requirements in order to be able to sell the house easier?
We are seeing that. So, it's not always the highest net offer is going to be the winner when it comes to a multiple offer situation. Some different ways that you could do that is reduce the amount of concessions, seller concessions, or seller paid closing costs, reduce or eliminate those. Removing that contingency of the home inspection is another thing that we're seeing. I caution buyers out there from doing so. If you have a really keen eye or have a knowledge in the trade to know that, a house is truly sound, that's kind of a big gamble, though. So you need to fully understand when you're waiving that right to an inspection what the ramifications are. And, some sellers are going to look at it, I feel like my home has been well-maintained and everything's good, but there is still a risk associated with what could come up during a home inspection.
Yeah, that's
true. And this is unbeknownst to the seller. So, yes, we are seeing some buyers using that as a competitive advantage, in multiple offers or just in the general offer writing process. Yeah.
Now, give me an idea from what you and your colleagues have figured out and what your bosses tell you, too, and what they've learned, how the market seems to be shaping up as we go now from the summer months into the fall. And we know things at some point slow down, usually at the end of the year or into the next year, because of the weather. Are you seeing it's going to continue to be a very, very busy selling and buying time here in Northwest Indiana?
Absolutely, Chris. I'm a big proponent, and when I speak to sellers, especially in third, fourth, and first quarter, in my opinion, I don't think that there is a selling season anymore. Year-round in Northwest Indiana is where we're seeing it. So with the limited inventory and life events that always occur, regardless of the season, deaths, marriages, divorces, job transfers, things like that, coupled with that limited inventory, I don't think that we're going to see much of a slowdown, if any.
We're talking with Laura Kaneshi, who is a broker associate for RE/MAX in LaPorte. The folks with RE/MAX and Integra Midwest have put out their 2018 Market Trends Report. Give us an idea about the latest housing data and trends in Indiana, and in particular here in Northwest Indiana. Laura, thanks for taking time to tell us about this report, how it fits into Northwest Indiana home buying and selling. And we appreciate the comments and hope we have a chance to talk with you again soon.
Very good. My pleasure. Thank you.
Statistics show that black men suffer disproportionately from diabetes and high blood pressure, among other health concerns. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports that a statewide initiative is working to increase the awareness of health issues among African Americans, including visiting some very popular conversation spots.
It's a busy Saturday afternoon at the Infinity Men's Salon just north of downtown Indianapolis. There are several chats happening in the shop, but amid the sounds of clippers and music, two volunteers sit at a table asking people if they want to participate in a free health screening.
Hi, how are you? You want your blood pressure, blood glucose check real fast?
Tracy Scott is a medical assistant and is checking blood pressure, blood sugar levels, and body mass index. Some of the statistics that can indicate health issues affecting black men.
In the black culture, African-American culture, high blood pressure, diabetes, being overweight, obviously that's very prominent.
She says she hopes bringing the screenings into a comfortable social setting will convince more of the barbershop's customers to seek preventative care.
You have a lot of people that walk in the door, especially on a Saturday. So, I mean, it's better than being in a clinic because you're not going to get as many people who've not been screened that walk into a clinic.
This is the eighth year of the Black Barbershop Health Initiative in Indiana. And these sorts of conversations have been happening all month as black men get a trim or a shave.
You gotta get your blood pressure down, man. Take when we get done, man.
Nah.
It's only gonna take a minute.
Infinity Men's Salon manager Richard Gladney has participated for several of those years and says he's encouraging all his customers to get tested.
The barbershop is like a cornerstone of our neighborhood and in the black community. And there's always a stigma with black, especially black men, not going to the doctor. So for some of us, this would be the only checkup we get. And so it's a place that a lot of black men come to. So it all comes together and works out perfect.
There are customers that turn down the offer, but eventually one approaches the table to get screened. 19-year-old Caliente Macklin sits down and rests his left arm on a table to check his blood pressure.
142 over 98.
It's a little high, which doesn't surprise him.
I did have a heart attack back in December. It pretty much puts me on my toes to be aware of my health, to make sure I'm in good standings because I got other people depending on me, like family members, my fiance, my brothers and sisters.
Macklin's had uncles die in their 40s because diagnoses of heart disease came too late to be treated. So he's glad he took advantage of the screening. Macklin says he likes the initiative, but wishes it was more widespread.
I actually think it's a good idea. It should be in multiple places because never know, there's somebody who wants to come by, wants to get their blood sugar checked, or wants to know if they're in good health standings, or just to figure out overall if their actual weight is their actual weight. So,
medical volunteer Tracy Scott says the screening also allows her to teach people about clinics nearby.
And then we also have some literature also that we hand out and showing people that there are free clinics in their areas that they can go to. A lot of people just don't realize that, they don't know. And information, knowledge is power.
Shop manager Richard Gladney says he's proud of the turnout and wishes the event could happen more often.
Once a year is definitely not enough because it's only on one day and we're open 7 days a week. So there's a lot of people that's not getting the experience. So even if you continue to do it on a Saturday, which is good because it's a busy day, it needs to be more Saturdays throughout the year so more people can experience it.
3 o'clock rolls around, ending the 6-hour outreach. Looking at the final list of participants, about 20 people took part in the screening. That's a record turnout for this particular shop and a sign that buzz may be growing about the need for more health screenings. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Sam says National Prevention Week is underway across the country, and with the Trump administration proposing some harsher penalties for drug offenders, it's time to take a look at a new survey out from WalletHub.com on how the states are with the biggest drug problems in 2018. Unfortunately, Indiana is ranked number 7 on the list. And for this, we turn to Jill Gonzalez, who's one of the analysts for WalletHub.com, and she's with us from the office today. Jill, thanks and welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me.
How was the data put together for all of the nation states, and how did Indiana seem to rank so poorly?
Yes, well, we looked at 20 different metrics ranging from arrest and overdose rates to opioid prescriptions and meth lab incidents per capita, really across three different categories. So one, just the sheer number of drug users and drug addiction throughout the state. We then looked at law enforcement to see kind of what's being done about this or what needs to be done. And finally, drug health issues and rehab metrics as well. And Indiana really could use the most help when it comes to actual drug users and law enforcement, which obviously I think goes hand in hand.
We know that the information that's on from Indiana mentions that Indiana is number 11 as far as the number of opioid pain reliever prescriptions per capita. And also we're number 16 as far as drug overdose deaths per capita, two very bad statistics. And obviously we can figure one of them out as far as the prescriptions per capita. That may be the case there. We have people that have gone to the hospital, had to have some surgery and the like, and they've been gotten perhaps over prescriptions, I suppose, and painkillers to deal with that.
Absolutely. We looked at the number of pain reliever prescriptions per 100 people, opioid pain relievers. And per 100 people, there are about 115 opioid prescriptions. So obviously, some case of being overprescribed here. And the reason why Indiana ranks fifth worst when it comes to law enforcement is because there are no drug monitoring prescription, drug monitoring laws there. Mm-hmm. So obviously, people are getting overprescribed. I mean, there's no law against it.
How does Indiana rank as far as the number of teenagers and the number of adults who managed to have used illicit drugs over, say, the last month or so?
Still in the top 15 here, which is not a place where you want to be at the top for one of these studies. So high number of share of teenagers who've used illicit drugs in the past month, high number who have been offered, sold, or given an illegal drug on school property, and that translates into adulthood as well, a very high share of adults who have used illicit drugs in the past month or so.
Now, working in conjunction with SAMHSA's on this, as well as the data that you've all put together there at WalletHub.com, what ideas do you think you folks might recommend to state officials to be able to try and turn some of this bad news around?
Well, I think that there are three, key policies here to put in place. One is that prescription drug monitoring law, which more and more states are enacting. It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to go ahead and do it. Also, states with employee drug testing laws, we want those to be authorized. And maternity drug policies, substance abuse during pregnancy, a crime. States with lower rates of that tend to mark it as a crime. So I think those three key policy issues are really what's needed here.
Now, if anybody would like to see more information about the full report, including Indiana and the other states in the country, and take a look at the 20 key metrics that were used in putting the report together, where can folks find out?
Head to WalletHub.com, and you'll find this study, one of our most recent, which is Drug Use by State 2018 Problem Areas.
Jill Gonzalez, an analyst for WalletHub.com. Jill, thanks very much for being with us.
Anytime.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I would describe homelessness by, it can mean you are living in the streets, you don't have anywhere to go, or you're living from house to house to house, and you don't know when somebody is going to kick you out, you don't know when you might end up on the streets. When you go from couch to couch or house to house, you have no idea when that's going to be the last person. If there's ever going to be any hope that you're going to find your own place or find a job that's going to pay you enough money to get your own place, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, that was my family who was putting me into homeless shelters. I lost my mom when I was 17, and my brother was 14 when we were living in Hammond. She died of cancer. We didn't have a lot of family. We were losing the house that my mom lived in. My mom's husband walked out on us. My brother's dad was a drug addict and couldn't do much for us. Before I turned 18, I went to legal aid, and they were able to help me as long as my brother's dad was willing to sign over his rights. And he was. And I took custody of my brother when I turned 18. And we had got some life insurance from my mom in order to get a place, pay the first year's rent, and get him in school and get the furniture and clothes that he needed. It was really hard. We didn't have nobody else. I mean, our situation wasn't that great in the first place, considering my mom was an alcoholic and a drug addict. But when somebody looked at me and said I wasn't going to get custody of my brother, I had to get custody of him. I didn't want to lose my mom and my brother at the same time.
Yeah, it was a lot to take care of. He was a
handful, especially after losing your mom. That's a traumatic stage to go through. And I understood because I lost her too, but he took it so much harder than I did that I couldn't wrap my hands around it, and I couldn't deal with it because I have my own emotional problems. And I'm like, how am I going to deal with your emotional problems when I have my own? I don't know what to do. And he didn't talk about it. He still does not talk about it to this day. He told me one time, he's like, I think it was better off that mom died. And I was like, why would you say that for? And he was like, because it made us better people. He was like, if we would have stayed with my mom, our mom, then the situation might not have played out the same. She taught us everything not to do. That's the way we look at it. She loved us, but she didn't love herself enough to take care of us the right way like she should have. So she taught us what not to do. And I think we beat statistics pretty well. I had him for a year, and he didn't listen to me so well. I had to put him on probation because he had 80 truancies in school. It was just like two teenagers living with each other and fighting all the time. So he moved in with his friend's mom, and he graduated on honors. But I felt hurt, but I was okay because I knew where he was going. He was going to be okay. I'm very proud of him, and I think my mom would be too. It was after I took custody of my brother. We had our own place, but we lost it. My brother moved out. And then I went to stay with a friend, and I found out I was pregnant. And then that friend's mom kicked me out for no reason. I was 6 months pregnant when she put me out. I lived with her after my mom died, before we had got our own place. And I had got a little bit of life insurance from my mother after she died. And I was able to give her a lot of money at that time. So then when I had moved out and found my own place, and we ran out of money, I moved back in with her, and we didn't have the money no more. And so I was still providing food and cleaning up. It wasn't enough. Then I moved in with my son's father and his sister, and then she left to move to another state. So then I ended up moving in with my aunt, and this is all after I had Jaden. And we lived with her, and then she put me out, and she put me in a homeless shelter. She thought if I lived in a homeless shelter that it would help me get on my feet faster than me living with her. So that was her opinion of it. And not saying it didn't work, but the way she approached it, because she took my stuff and she sold it or took it somewhere else and gave it to other people. So I was pretty upset. And it was my son's stuff, too, like his walkers, his swings, all of that stuff. She took it, and she just got rid of it because I couldn't come and get it because we were in a homeless shelter. So I think she could have handled that a little bit different.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu.
We are at the graduation day point for many students who are in college these days, and for them it's going to mean becoming a member of the national workforce, maybe for the first time. Well, unfortunately for many, it also means that they're not quite ready to be able to have the financial education to be able to join the rest of the real world, so to speak. And so now we're going to turn to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer for a little advice. Greg, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start out first about some of the important things, probably one of the most important things, if a millennial doesn't have it already, is to have a budget all prepared. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, going through graduation, unfortunately, a lot of the practical applications aren't taught, and just, you know, what would be common sense to somebody that's gotten beaten up in the trenches over the years like you or I. A lot of these young kids just don't realize that, you know, what type of budget to set up or how to kind of rationalize what you're spending. And a lot of the simple rules, like we consider what we call a 50-20-30 split, mm-hmm. where you know, fixed expenses like your rent, utilities, car payments, if you start representing more than 50% of your income in those fixed payments, it becomes a little bit difficult to do with all the other things that you're going to need to. One specifically is saving. You know, we need to save, and that's where, you know, we always try to set the goal for 20%, which is higher than in the past because, you know, the target is always be the 10%, but a lot of the benefits are going away. You know, pensions are kind of a thing of the past. It's more on the individual than it's ever been. And then the last 30% would be those ancillary things, you know, the expenses like groceries or other things that you want to do for hobbies or entertainment.
One of the things we know, too, and when it comes time to doing the budget, and you talk here about specifically about saving, that's very important, and it's something that the older you get, the less likely is that you're going to have much time to be able to do much saving. So I guess if you're at the other end of the age scale, it's time to start saving now.
Yeah, absolutely, and every little bit counts. You know, time is always one of the biggest advantages of any type of investment program. Results become more predictable. Money has more time to compound. And if you start doing amounts now, it becomes part of that regular budget. You know, you start with whatever you can, specifically things these young folks need to look at. If you do have a 401k and there's any type of matching in the contribution that your employer is willing to do, we always talk about free money. Make sure you're taking advantage of that right from the onset. And if you don't have those types of vehicles at work, it's even more critical to look at starting something on your own in the way of an IRA or some other contribution to begin saving for your future. And investing early gives you it's a lot less money required to get the same results.
Now, obviously, when you talk about 401k, many of people are saving on their own. If they do happen to be lucky enough to get into a job, especially that first really big job that offers some type of retirement savings, what type of advice do you give when they get a chance to talk with their employer about just a regular plan that might be set up through the company they're working for?
Yeah, and so a lot of the companies are going more towards the what we call just defined contributions instead of benefits. And exactly like you said, you know, these 401ks, you need to inquire about them. Hey, what do you have? And it may not be a 401k. It might be a similar type plan like a 403b or, you know, some type of simple program, depending on the company. But immediately go and investigate what types of things are available through that employer, when your eligibility begins. What type of matching dollars, like we mentioned earlier. It's on the individual to go, you know, be aggressive and find out what is available to them. And it's going to be more so like that, I think, moving forward than ever in the past.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about what the millennials should be doing once they get out of college, get that degree, and actually go out and start to work in the real world other than what maybe they might have been doing while in college. Speaking of college, that means the student debt's going to be a big problem too, and that's something else I guess millennials have to be sure to work out is how they're going to be able to wangle that into their other expenses.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with the student loans, especially, you know, today, I my kids are not in college yet, and I worry about the amount of money it's going to cost me and them to get through college. And unfortunately, today, most people are financing it, money well spent in terms of getting the education. But that debt usually is going to be a time horizon to pay off because of the size of it. And in addition to that, you know, one of the traps you want to be careful with is, you know, today's world is all about no cash. It still surprises me today, Chris. I always carry cash, at least something around in my pocket. The younger generation today, it's all plastic, it's all debits, it's all credit cards, and very easy to slip into additional debt that could be prohibitive to, not only saving but getting out of debt.
Mm-hmm. Now, finally, Greg, I know we've talked about this in the past, of course, and you just kind of alluded to it at the start of our conversation about the fact that millennials may be getting out of college and they don't have any courses typically any longer in college where you're going to learn to handle financial matters of any kind. So I guess it means that it takes upon yourself that important time to get yourself educated financially. What should students and graduates now be doing to be able to be prepared for life and be able to financially deal with things as well?
Well, I think there's a lot of practical knowledge that they can gain just by being a little bit diligent in the process of educating themselves. You know, just finding out some of the things that are available and not, you know, spontaneously making decisions about things without understanding, you know, a little bit more about everything else involved. Simple example, you know, buying a home seems pretty straightforward, but people don't realize what it takes to maintain a home in addition to that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the challenges today is there's a lot of sources, as I call them, out there, but some of those sources aren't always the most accurate. So, you know, just relying on one thing printed is not necessarily where the education should stop. You know, investigate other sources, make sure that, you know, the sources are vented and that you're getting good information. But, you know, the key is any information that you get in the way of sound investment principles, sound, you know, planning principles, sound budgeting principles is going to be beneficial and give you a better basis to draw and make decisions on.
Have you found over the years here and talking with your clients there, as well as just people in general, that that there are enough sources out there that they can at least kind of get the basics, and especially when you're starting out in life like this and going into your first real serious job, to be able to live your life that you want to live and still be able to save back to plan for the future?
Yeah, and I think the key is you know, a lot of times, and we always talk about budgets, and budgets are a word that's around, but budgets don't always tell the whole story. So a lot of the information we encourage people to understand is, you know, you put down a budget, but, you know, what are the ancillary things that, that happen or occur that cost money? And, you know, one way to do it, a simple principle, is write down every penny you spend over the course of a month or 60 days and see what that ancillary spending is to maintain your lifestyle. So budgets don't always tell the full story, but starting with the budget helps, and then understanding how to create the budget is part of it, right? Because input's only going to be as good as output. A lot of people evaluate, hey, I can afford this house. Here's my mortgage payment. Here's my utilities. Well, you and I both know that's not where the cost of a house ends, right? There's
a lot
of other things with it. So just being a little bit more in-depth and a little bit more informed about what it takes to do things. And a lot of times those sources don't have to be books, you know. Having conversations with people that have done it before. Hey, explain to me a little bit more about what it takes to do A, B, or C.
Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer, as always, thanks for being with us and the advice, and we'll look forward to talking again real soon.
Thanks, Chris. Enjoyed it.
The indirect effects of the opioid epidemic are far-reaching. The healthcare sector, where opioid medications are often widely available, is experiencing an uptick in violence. Last summer, a man in northern Indiana killed a doctor who refused to prescribe an opioid medication to his wife. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Miranda Fulmore reports that hospitals and doctors' offices around the country are responding, and they're taking steps to protect their employees and their patients.
Every month, employees gather in the basement of Greene County General Hospital.
We're not here to learn pressure points, joint manipulations.
They're learning how to de-escalate situations and defend themselves if things get violent.
First part of it is actually taking care of yourself, making sure that you're in the right place and the right frame of mind.
That's Officer Brian Woodall. He started the program in 2014. He says for half the day, participants learn how to talk to people, including how to keep them calm.
The favorite phrase that everybody loves to say is calm down. That absolutely sets people off.
The training was originally voluntary, but the hospital started requiring it as the opioid crisis reached epidemic proportions and the street value of opioids skyrocketed.
They've started putting more restrictions on doctors on what they can prescribe. And I think that is one of the big areas of what the issue is.
Health officials say engaging with people who are addicted to opioids is a statewide concern. It doesn't matter if you're at a small rural hospital or a larger level one trauma center like Riley Hospital in Indianapolis.
I think, you know, the data says very clearly that hospitals are the most violent place to work, except policemen, firemen, those first responders.
That's Dr. Elaine Cox. She's a professor of clinical pediatrics and the chief medical officer at Riley Hospital. She says if you look back as recently as the last decade, you would see this hasn't always been the case.
There are a lot of things in society that I think are magnified by the opioid crisis in America. I think, you know, the drug-seeking behavior, some of the violence that we do see when someone cannot get those medications. And so we're trying to make it better by clamping down on that.
Numbers by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration show violence against healthcare providers nearly doubled between 2012 and 2014. Cox says hospitals can take extra precautions. Riley Hospital, for example, requires everyone to pass through a body scanner. But that's not something small rural hospitals can necessarily afford. Greene County's solution is to have at least one armed security guard on duty at all times.
Until a couple years ago, we didn't have security or any able-bodied people that could help us in situations, especially at night. And coming from someone who worked nights 18 years, it is scary if you're the only person with someone's out of control here.
That's Jill Raines. She's the director of quality at Greene County General Hospital. She says the security guards make her feel safer. Raines has taken the safety class twice, and she says the hospital's increased focus on security is working. In 2015, the hospital reported 150 incidents where outside law enforcement was called. That dropped to 50 in 2017. The second half of the day focuses on physical training.
Somebody grab a hold of the other arm like they're going to scratch. So you're going to grab the back of their hand.
Employees practice hands-on exercises like breaking free if someone grabs them, pulls their hair, or even puts them in a headlock. And hospital employees are not the only ones benefiting from the training.
If we're afraid to take care of somebody, then obviously you're not going to get the best care. So I do believe that this program has really helped increase the confidence and awareness that we as an organization and our administration and our board wants us to be safe here.
Raines says they can't predict when violence will happen, but they can be prepared. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Miranda Fulmore.
We're getting word of more contamination problems because of lead and other toxics in Northwest Indiana. This time we're finding out about another lead-contaminated neighborhood near East Chicago. And to that, we are turning to the fellow who wrote the story for the Chicago Tribune, Michael Hawthorne. He's covered other environmental issues. We've had him on before to talk about them. And Michael, thanks for joining us again on Regionally Speaking.
Great to be with you.
Well, fill us in here is what we know so far about the problems that more neighborhoods in Northwest Indiana, in particular around Hammond and around Whiting, are facing now.
This is very similar to what happened in East Chicago, where there was lead smelters that were abandoned long ago. In this case, in the Hammond-Whiting area, it was a facility called Federated Metals that operated from the early 1930s to the early 1980s. And, you know, a lot of other industry in the area, neighborhoods were built very close to these places where people worked, right? And so I think people have been accustomed, longtime people who've lived in the neighborhoods, they're accustomed to the fact that they live close to industry. But what we're finding now, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency was created in the early 1970s. They went after some of the really tough, easy-to-see sources of pollution, say U.S. Steel dumping waste into Lake Michigan. And what I think is going on now is they're going back and looking at some of these sites that they might have taken a look at, or they might have done some level of cleanup years ago, and they're finding that it wasn't enough. And of greater concern for people in the Robertsdale neighborhood of Hammond and in Whiting, the lead from Federated Metals appears to have drifted far beyond the property where the smelter operated. And so you're finding, what the EPA is finding, is there are staggeringly high levels of lead in residential soil. And so far, at least, PA has not done a lot in terms of informing residents what they might be facing.
Are we finding in these cases, from what you can tell, and maybe you've found out from some of the documents you've looked into, that this migration of the contamination is either maybe from airborne material, or if it's
certain that the material we're talking about here either was emitted through what they call fugitive dust. A lot of these facilities had big vents where waste that didn't go up a smokestack pollution just went out into the air and drifted into the neighborhood. Prevailing winds from this particular facility would generally go toward the north and the northeast. So we're talking Robertsdale and Whiting. And, you know, it operate most of the time that this facility operated, there wasn't an EPA, and there wasn't really a lot of pollution control laws or regulations on the books. What I was really struck by reading some of the historic documents that the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency have posted, they were very concerned in the 1980s about ground contamination from Federated Metals.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like they were concerned about this from other facilities in the area as well. It appears that no one ever bothered to ask, did the whole pollution that came out of this particular facility, was it deposited in the yards of neighbors close by? They're finding that out now. So it seems like every time they sample soil somewhere in northwest Indiana and southeast Chicago, they're finding dangerous levels of different heavy metals that have been used by industry in the area for a long time. In some cases, they're still being used.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're finding is cause for concern because it can be harmful not only to young children but also to adults.
I know you talked to some residents who live there along Lakeview Street, which is just north of where the smelter used to be located there in Robertsdale, and they're very, very concerned not only about the potential contamination that they're facing now, but also the fact they never got told very much, if at all, by any officials about it.
Well, I think some people would just think, hey, that building was there for quite a while. Mm-hmm. It was vacant or was used for other purposes. People who pay really close attention to environmental issues in Northwest Indiana have pointed out to Governor Holcomb and to members of the environmental agency that they're finding this legacy of pollution in the neighborhoods at the same time that the state of Indiana is permitting other lead processing facilities to operate in the same building.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they might not release as much pollution as was estimated to come out of the Federated Metals smelter when it was operating there, but it's still a source of lead. And back in December, when IDEM renewed a permit for the current occupant, it's called Whiting Metals, there were a number of concerns from people in the Robertsdale and Whiting neighborhoods that there should be a public hearing, that there should be an airing of public concerns, not only about historic contamination from old abandoned industry in the area, also from current emitting facilities. IDEM said no to that, and they renewed the permit, but these issues still remain.
I know that you have in your story that's online in the Tribune and in the Post Tribune, as well as available in the print version, talking about the fact that we had EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt and Governor Eric Holcomb coming up in the area, and they apparently slipped in and took a look at some of this and never told anybody. Or certainly the media never found out, and the neighbors certainly apparently didn't find out either.
That's one of these odd things, and we're seeing a lot in the national press about Pruitt's secret visits, oftentimes very tight security. I counted on a video that one of the neighborhood activists shot with their camera phone at least three security members around Pruitt and Holcomb during this surprise visit to a yard near the Federated Metals plant or building. And again, right, like you said, there was no media announcement of this until after the fact. In fact, Hammond's mayor wasn't even notified of it. So they showed up. I'm not exactly sure what the reason was, other than to be photographed. The governor and Administrator Pruitt were photographed shaking hands, flanked by the Whiting mayor and by the regional administrator for the EPA here in the Chicago office. But there wasn't a lot of details, and it wasn't until I started asking questions of the EPA, hey, what do you know about this facility? What are you going to be doing in the future about the lead you've already found in the neighborhood? It took them a while to kind of come up with some answers to that, because I think the Trump administration's EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, caught people by surprise by showing up suddenly and then saying, hey, we're going to earmark $1.7 million to clean up at least 20 homes where women and children are living and they could be especially at risk to lead poisoning. It raises a lot of other questions about the rest of the neighborhood, how much more testing is going to be done. In April, the EPA was out there. Not a lot of people know about this, but the EPA was out once again testing soil in the neighborhood. There are no results yet from that. This is very similar to what Pruitt did in East Chicago, where he visited the Superfund site there, the West Calumet housing project that's now being torn down. Paid a secret visit there to East Chicago and said this was going to be one of his top priorities. There are a lot of open questions about the pace of the cleanup, the extent of the cleanup, and then just at basic level, the public notification about what's going on.
I know you had a chance to speak with David Dapperton from Hammond, who used to work for IDEM when they used to have a Northwest Indiana office back, I guess, in the early 1990s. I'm sure that he's very concerned about this and had a chance to talk with some of the neighbors in the area about it, too.
I get a sense talking with him, and it's from reading some of old news clippings where he was quoted about different issues back in the 90s. He struck me as kind of a Don the effort of trying to raise more attention about current and former industry in Northwest Indiana. As far as he sees it, the folks down in Indianapolis just don't want to hear about that. They don't necessarily want to pay attention at all, in his mind, to Northwest Indiana. But what happens is there are people like Dapperton and Thomas Frank in the Hammond area, and activists who are they're getting together with people in East Chicago and the southeast side of Chicago and Flint, Michigan, and other places around the country that have been impacted by industrial pollution, and they're raising questions, and they're essentially forcing public officials accountable to start telling people what they might be exposed to out there, and it is. I think very concerning. Everybody that I've talked to in those areas, if they find out what's going on, they're very concerned. The question is, are they looking for these things?
Well, I guess we'll find out if EPA or IDEM or some agency that will take a look into this more detail will finally come up with an opportunity there to hold another public hearing, much as what I'm sure they are not necessarily looking forward to, but it's turned out to be that way, to be sure. Michael Hawthorne is a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He has a story that is in print and online here about another discovery of another lead-contaminated neighborhood near East Chicago. And, Michael, thanks very much for being with us to talk about this today.
Thanks for having me.
Lawmakers in Indianapolis approved two substantial tax measures during the Monday one-day special session. Many of the provisions sought to conform state tax laws with some major policy changes made by the recent federal tax reform bill, which Republican Senator Travis Holdman says is part of why a special session is necessary.
A lot of the deductions that are allowed at the federal level, if we did not couple in cases or decouple in many of those cases, we would see significant tax increases for local taxpayers.
But Democratic Senator Karen Talion of Ogden Dunes says that picking and choosing, as Holdman mentions, isn't really a very good idea because it's going to cost the state a lot of money.
If we adopted all of the federal rules, we'd get a big windfall to the state revenue.
One of the changes the legislature adopted, Hoosiers can now use some of those 529 college savings dollars they put away to pay for K-12 school tuition. Democrat Representative Terry Austin says that's fine, but it only really helps with those that are sending their children to private schools, and they already get a tax credit for their tuition payments.
The vast majority of families who send their children to our public schools have significant expenses, but we're not even acknowledging textbooks yet. And so at some point, I think we've got to be fair.
The tax measures passed overwhelmingly in both chambers. South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg's veto of a zoning request for a pro-life non-medical facility will stand. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Anciano reports that this comes after the city's Common Council voted 5-4 to override the veto.
The council cited 5 rezoning criteria they used to allow Women's Care Center, a pro-life non-medical facility, to open an office next to Whole Women's Health Alliance, which could soon become an abortion provider in South Bend. Mayor Pete Buttigieg vetoed the rezone. Council members who voted against the mayor's veto say it was unsubstantiated. Buttigieg objected to the proximity to the women's clinic. Vice President of the pro-life group, Jenny Hunsberger, says its board will decide what's next for the property, which it owns.
And we have been in this community for 34 years, and we will continue to be in this community to care for and serve the women and families.
Director of the Women's Clinic, Sharon Lau, says they are happy with the outcome. Lau says Whole Women's Health Alliance is still pursuing a license and hopes to provide some women's health services, including STD testing, while they complete that process. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
Indianapolis-based Eli Lilly and Company hopes that a recent purchase will boost its cancer drug portfolio. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports that the $1.6 billion buyout of AMRO Bioscience would benefit both companies.
Immunotherapy treatments, which train the body to fight disease, have gained momentum recently. University of Michigan professor Sharish Gadgil says Lilly hopes it'll work with tumors.
Now that you block that process, the patient's immune system now can recognize the cancer as abnormal or cancerous tissue and attack it and potentially even eradicate it.
Eli Lilly bought Armo Bioscience because it has a pancreatic cancer drug in late-stage clinical trials. But Gadgil says Armo might have had trouble, even if its medicine works. So a buyout now makes sense.
Generally, these companies can develop a drug, but then that final step of drug approval and then drug marketing can be fairly challenging for small companies.
The deal must first be approved by regulators, but Lilly expects the deal to close by the end of the second quarter. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.